This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Let us get on with the Q&A for the evening, and I will see if I can keep as far away as I can from the app so that it doesn't start shrieking at me. We'll start with David. I mentioned in the introduction that you've written this role-playing game with Cthulhu, and the story clearly had, you know, things when the stars are right and whatever. So lots of people are fascinated with Lovecraft and his work. Can you tell us a little bit about what it means to you?
Yeah, sure. Lovecraft was a major inspiration for me as a young boy. It really warped my imagination, and I think it's a fantastic form of horror. What's really pleasing is to see that it's creeping more mainstream these days. So you've got Del Toro, who did some Pacific Rim? Yeah. He's really keen to kind of do the classic Lovecraft novel, At the Mountains of Madness, and has gratefully declined the money from Warner Brothers because they want to have a love interest and a happy ending. Lovecraft doesn't have that. Yeah. So anyway, I grew up on Call of Cthulhu. Obviously, got into Lovecraft at that point, and also got into role playing games. And around about the age of 26, I started developing my own systems, which was to support my own writing world, the universe I was writing within. And then around about 2005. I'd had this game going for a number of years, about 10 years, had a regular crew of players, it was all good, everyone was, you know, cozy, every 3 weeks we'd get together and play on the weekend, playing this game. And then this new guy came in, this new player. And he turned up, and he hadn't played it before, and so all these systems which I'd written, which are kind of like organically grown and all sort of cyberpunk, he had never seen them, and so he went, "No, this doesn't work. No, this is wrong. Where is he?" So 10 years of work went down the shithole, literally, and I didn't call him again for about a year. But around about 2006, I had this idea of like, well, okay, there's a world here that I'm writing within. Maybe I can take the game system to another level. I came up with the idea of Yellow Dawn, which is, what if the Cthulhu mythos actually delivers an apocalyptic event and wins in some way, but in the best intents of man and machine, it fucks up. So it's a partial mythos victory, screwed up by men's incompetence. And that's Yellow Dawn. It's an apocalyptic event that leaves the world decimated, with survivor settlements all over the place.
Now, Lovecraft is pretty notorious for being a hideous racist and a pretty unpleasant fellow in many ways. I noticed that you got around that fairly neatly by having the hideous monsters massacre a bunch of Nazis, which was, you know, that was a cool idea. But How do you take that aspect of what's in Lovecraft and deal with it in your work?
I don't really think about it. Although, I mean, so Lovecraft was in an era where racism was rife within his own culture, the American culture, and he was a vulnerable personality. He moved to New York, was living in Brooklyn, where there was a lot of immigrants from sort of the North African countries and Middle East. He just, you know, he freaked out, didn't like them. So I think that kind of fed into his fear. And then you obviously have the Himmler and his stories of the pure Aryan race and how things would be great if we could only purify the blood. So all that awful bullshit. So yeah, I just don't think about Lovecraft and his racism. I think about Lovecraft and his amazing imagination and the ideas he brought through.
Talking about horrible things, Pete, I noticed you went a little bit grimdark in that novel. And I suspect that everybody is interested to hear a little bit more about the whole setup, because we've only got a tiny little bit of it. So what can you tell us about these seven warriors?
I'm not sure what grimdark is, actually. Apart from that Joe writes it, apparently. Okay, so the seven-word pitch for the novel is: cursed crusader seeks absolution through several lifetimes. And obviously it has to be a seven-word pitch, because the word seven, the number seven is quite important in the book. So it's set in the Crusade, the First Crusade, where these seven knights form a new knightly order around the seven heavenly virtues, and they end up doing a magical ceremony which goes wrong and curses them with the seven deadly sins. And they're occasionally reborn through time, and one of them, the main character, Raymond, who is Patience and Wrath, attempts to stop the curse in the modern day.
Well, it certainly sounds like a fascinating setup, and I look forward to hearing more of it in due course. Now, the Magpie book, we've heard several stories from now. You read one at the Thunderbolt the other night, and I think you have one at the Flash Fiction event as well. So how is that coming along? Are we actually at the point where you've got all of the stories that you need to put it together, or are you still working on them?
I'm still working. So the first story, One for Sorrow, I've actually got two stories partly written, and I'm not sure which one I'm going to choose, although Justin suggested I should put both in, which is an interesting idea. And Four for Death or Birth, I've not thought about yet. But mostly it's writing itself. So it basically started from, I wrote a story which had a character called the Seventh Magpie in. Then I wrote another story about serial killers who counted crows. And then I wrote another story, the roadkill story that I read out of the Flash. I thought, I'm actually writing lots of stories about these magpie counting things, so best make that a thing then.
Well, yes, and you know, if you've got a system and it works, then get on with it. So at least now we never need to ask people again where they get their ideas from, because you have given away the secret. You've told everybody. Which I you might get drummed out of the Writers' Union for that, of course. Okay. Has anybody in the audience got any questions for our two readers tonight before I start boring you all with questions about role-playing games? Yes, Dave.
David, you said that your story had been commissioned by John Houlihan. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, he's a thug. he invited me to write a short story a few months ago for an anthology he's doing for Achtung Cthulhu, which I didn't really explain actually. Achtung Cthulhu is a Kickstarter project launched by Modiphius for Call of Cthulhu in the 1940s, World War II genre. It's done very, very, very well, so I was delighted to be invited to be part of that. They were looking for writers to help expand that universe. So rather than tables and numbers and charts, we're a game, sort of words that people could relate to. So I said, yeah, I'll write a short story for that. And then I started writing four novels and got busy with that. So about a month ago, John just pinged me an email saying, hey, I really need your pitch, like tomorrow. So I was like, okay. So I had to come up with a 1940s Call of Cthulhu piece of original fiction. So I was sitting on the bus thinking, and I'd been to the Arctic last year, was in Norway, in Svalbard, and there was a World War II bunker, and I thought, that'd be great, that's where I'll start it, and that was it. So, I came up with the pitch, he accepted it, and then the following week I wrote it in 3 days, 6,000 words, very happy.
That's very impressive. I've remembered now that a long time ago, Marcus Rowland wrote this Call of Cthulhu adventure with Nazi nuns on motorbikes. Because Marcus used to do things like that, and that will be perfect for that book. I hope the idea is still out there. Anybody else got any questions for our readers? Claire?
The poem about the crows. I'd like to know where you got your version of it, because I've got a different version that I grew up with. One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy, and then five for silver, six for gold, and then seven for the secret that's never been told. But you've got a different version, so where did you get your version?
I know where you got yours from, Claire. That was that TV programme, wasn't
it? Yeah, it's actually the traditional version. It's mentioned quite a long time ago, actually. Yeah, the difference is being one for sorrow, two for mirth, three for a wedding, four for a birth or death, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never to be told, eight for heaven, nine for hell, and ten for the devil to himself.
Yeah, for those who are very young, there used to be a TV programme, I think on ITV, in the kids' slot in the afternoon called Magpie, and they may have actually rewritten the poem for that to make it less scary for children. I don't know. Does anybody know? I'll have to go and look it up on Wikipedia when we get home, and the answer will be wrong. Any more questions?
Justin?
Tell us about your four novels. I mean, just four novels. Just four novels you're writing. Yeah. What are they about?
Okay, one's called, there's Oakfield, there's Broken Fury, Thunder Gloom, and Rise of the Iconoclast. I'm actually doing less writing, but so the past few years I've been really burning the candle at both ends, getting up at 4 a.m. to write, then doing my full-time job, then writing at lunchtimes, writing at night, writing weekends, and basically not seeing mates and not seeing my girlfriend. Got a lot done, but decided that after 8 books it was time to kind of like ease off a bit. So this year I'm doing 45 minutes a day and that's it, but that's what I sign up to do. And that's the first book, Oakfield, which I do every day, and it's great. and that's a Cthulhu Mythos horror story set in a remote Cornish town, which is basically Mygo, Fungo from Yogath, mining thing. But what I now do, because I'm now seeing I've got more time to myself, I'm actually then allowing myself to play with other books. I'm actually enjoying writing a game rather than being a job. It's sort of just experimenting and kicking stuff around. So Broken Fury is a cyberpunk mercenary story set in Norway. Son of the Gloom is a follow-on from Living in Flames, which is a horror story I write about Bristol, the clubbing and drug scene, where a 300-year-old cult services and unleashes horror upon Bristol. So Son of the Gloom is a follow-on from that, and it's basically what happens to the horror that took place in that one, in Living in Flames. And Rise of the Iconoclast is a bit tongue-in-cheek, cyborgs kicking around the Mediterranean in an aerodyne after Yellow Dawn's happened, just kind of trying to survive.
A little bit of help for your Bristol story. It's become a thing now that if you're setting any sort of story in Bristol, you have to destroy Cabot Circus. Tim Morn did it in Flight Path Estate, and Kevin Scott has done it in the superhero book that he read from when he was here last month. So, and yeah,
I did it before it was even built.
Yeah, I crashed a helicopter through the roof.
Yes, and Joe has destroyed Cabot Circus as well. Destroying Cabot Circus is the thing to do. I'm sure you can work it into your book.
How about the darkness of the mythos suddenly emerging inside of the eggshell fabric? You know, it's kind of bioorganic, isn't it, that thing? Suddenly it comes alive and mindless zombie shoppers going, "Ear, what's that? Ah!"
I have a sneaking suspicion that the angles in Cabot Circus aren't natural to begin with, actually. Talking of which, as well as doing the books, you've written this role-playing game, and you know, it's been a long time since I've actually encountered somebody who's written their own system and everything, rather than just, you know, playing one of the games off the shelf. I thought those days were gone, so I'm pleased to see that. I'm interested to know what sort of philosophy you've got in terms of game design, and what existing games are your favourites that you try to take the best bits out of.
So Yellow Dawn is designed around the idea of the world of my fiction, so the universe that my books take place within, but twisted to the lens of an apocalyptic event. So the Cthulhu mythos has obviously delivered a strike against humanity, which didn't quite go according to the plan. The actual system itself, I've tailored it to make sure that people who play Call of Cthulhu could take the existing campaigns they've got, the old BRP system, 3d6 for stats and 1d100 for percentile for skill systems, take their old favourite scenarios and transport them into the world of Yellow Dawn. What I found is a lot of people have responded very, very well to Yellow Dawn. They've been very, very complimentary about the amount of work I put into it. It was quite a large amount of work. And they've said that if you don't quite like the system, you can take a lot from the actual rules to scavenge them and put them into your own systems. The actual setting as well. I did a massive overhaul back in 2012 based on fan feedback to disconnect the actual rule systems from the setting. So you can buy the rule now, the core rule book for Yellow Dawn, and either use the rule systems or go straight to the front and read the actual setting and just use that for your own systems.
Well, one of the reasons I'm so fond of Call of Cthulhu is that it turns the classic structure of role-playing games on their head. In Dungeons & Dragons, as your character progresses through the game and plays more and more, you get more and more powerful. And in Call of Cthulhu, the more your character plays, the more they start to go insane. Given that you have a mythos-based game, do you have sanity rolls and things?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a stat called Cool, which is the ability of your character to come across telling lies, sustain shocking encounters, well, not shocking encounters, but to remain cool under combat. But that system is also used, if you encounter the mythos, you have anxiety rolls. So if you fail a cool check, you basically suffer the consequences of, you can't move forward, you're frozen by fear. But if you use a cool stat for an anxiety check, fail, your cool goes down, so you start to reduce your sanity. I did a really, really good scenario by a fantastic guy called Simon Brake. I wish I could remember what he eventually published it in. I'll try and dig out and remember it and put on the blog if you guys are doing a podcast for this, but it's a character killer. Literally. I had a bunch of characters who've been playing Yellow Dawn since about 2007. I mean, they were massively powerful and half insane. Horgan will know about this one. And I thought, right, it's time to finish them off. So I put them through this Summon Breaks scenario. Just set out in the woods somewhere remote. And all of them either died, went insane, or turned into these feral woodland creatures, all worshipping Shub-Niggurath. Fantastic. Fantastic ending.
A perfect ending to a Call of Cthulhu type game, yes. Have we got any more questions from anybody? Looking around the audience. Yeah, Justin.
I'm intrigued by this horror business. I wonder, have you done... have you looked at the origins of horror? I mean, what's your working definition of horror at the moment, and how has it changed? And when you write, have you ever written from real horror?
That's a really profound question. Definition of horror. I mean, I'm woefully underread. I think I'm... For me, the definition of horror is being out of your comfort zone. And then you obviously have... in my world, there's two layers of horror after that. There's supernatural horror, which is the horror of our realm as human beings within this thing called the quantosphere, the realm of demons, bad energies, things which feed upon our fears, things which generate fears. We've all encountered those, ghosts, and the feeling of something unusual in a room or a house, the feeling of being uneasy in a woods, somewhere dark, or a place, maybe a graveyard or a factory even, where it's just you feel like there's a depressing cloud upon you. That to me is mundane horror. And then there's the horror of Lovecraft, there's the horror of the outer chaos. It's that sort of hard to even picture, that hard to define horror, where something presents itself to you that's so alien, so out of this world, you almost want to call it an alien being, but it's not, because what you're seeing is actually just a fragment of its real reality, its real presence in this universe. It's something that's reaching through from beyond. And that's the kind of horror which I do enjoy playing with and writing about. As far as my own experiences of horror, I've been kneecapped in Newcastle when I was 20. I've been kidnapped in Budapest by Russian organized crime, held to ransom. Grew up in a haunted house. Yeah, had a few interesting experiences.
Yeah, but nothing as awful as having a microphone stuck in your face and having people ask you complicated philosophical questions about the history of horror. I got a few books by John Clute I can recommend to you there, Justin. Do we have any more questions this evening? All right. Yeah, okay, we need to know more about the Budapest thing.
I'll say two words. Honey trap.
Yes, right. Yeah. Clearly, if we knew any more about that, David would have to kill us. And that would not be good. David.
I just want to say a nod to Tom, who I've met today. He's in the audience here. And Tom has a really exciting idea for a short story he's working on. A big fan of M.R. James. And also really, really exciting for a novel, which I heard today. And I wonder if you want to say a few words about your novel idea. Maybe whet the appetite of the people who listen to this podcast.
Now, don't give too many ideas away, Tom. They'll all steal them.
Okay, I'll be brief. Hello, everyone. So I have a Victorian gothic horror that is set in Walthamstow called The Ladies of Walthamstow. And it's about a down-on-his-luck music hall pianist who gets offered a job as a piano tutor for some new money industry folk. And he goes up and gets involved in the middle of a political storm of the rural locals who don't like the new money coming in, and they summon something, and then something gets very, very interesting. So hopefully I'll have more for you, and maybe possibly even a reading come November. So have a look out for that. Thank you.
There are a few things more horrific than Victorian ladies. Pete, you have a question.
Plug. A
thought it was time for plugs. On Saturday, I'm going to be at the Lansdowne doing the National Flash Fiction Day reading with Kevlin Henney and Mazzy and a few other people that have that would be very familiar to everybody here. I think it starts at 7. And I'll be doing some sort of psychological horror, actually.
Yeah, so there's the reading at the Lansdowne, which I think they've made free. Maybe. So that's free, that's up in Clifton. And also, I'm not sure if there are any places left, but during the day they're doing a flash fiction writing workshop at the Central Library, which I know Mazian is involved with, and I think Tanya Hirschman as well. Yeah, and Jonathan Pinnock. So lots and lots of fabulous flash fiction stuff going on the shortest day of the year. And now it's the time where I torture Claire, stick the microphone in her face, and ask her what's going to happen next month.
Next month, it'll be July 21st, and we will have Andy Goodman and Kenneth Peter Shin. So, yay!
Marvellous. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you in particular to our two fabulous readers, Dave J. Roger and Pete Sutton. And we'll look forward to seeing you all on July the 21st.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.